was just about an hour after sunrise on December 7th in 1941 when the fate of America changed forever.
The attack on Pearl Harbor united Americans as never before in history. In the explosions at Pearl Harbor, there was forged the will for complete and absolute victory over the forces of evil.
It's been 75 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor. The story of what happened that day has been well documented, even romanticized on the silver screen. And you may think you've heard all there is to know about the attack. But a new book by my next guest offers some fresh perspectives on the tragedy, the politics, and the heroism as well from that day. Craig Nelson is the author of the new book, Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. He'll be in Atlanta next week to talk about the book, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start with your Georgia connection, because as I understand all this, this is not in the book. Your mother was working in Atlanta during the war as an air traffic controller, right?
Yes, both my parents worked during World War II. My father was stationed with the Air Force in New Guinea, and my mother worked was a war worker working as an airplane controller in Atlanta, and now my best friend from high school lives there. So I'm very tied to the Peaches.
So why another book on Pearl Harbor? As I mentioned, there have been so many books on it, so many movies, both good and bad. What do we still not know?
Well, the last really big definitive history of Pearl Harbor was researched 50 years ago. And between the fact that we didn't have much material on the Japanese then, that so many of the eyewitnesses were traumatized by what they had gone through, and that so many people had experiences of Pearl Harbor that hadn't come through, and we didn't have the historical perspective, I felt it was time for a new one. And I put together a team and spent 5 years researching and writing this book. And I came to the decision that Pearl Harbor is really what made America what we are today. Our leadership role on the global stage, that we have the biggest military in the world, the size of our intelligence agencies, the size of our overseas financial aid programs and foreign aid programs, the beginning of our nuclear arsenal, and the fact that we haven't had a World War III in 70 years all began at Pearl Harbor.
So this is the argument, more like the central premise of this book. And one of the things that you argue is about all of the warnings that the U.S. government had. There have long been conspiracy theories about Pearl Harbor, but what did you discover about what the government did and did not know before the attack happened?
Well, there were actually only two real significant warnings. One came in January 1941, almost a year before the attack, when the Peruvian ambassador in Japan warned the American ambassador in Japan that he had heard rumors that if things deteriorate further between the United States and Tokyo, that Tokyo will attack Pearl Harbor. And our ambassador passed this on up, and it went to the military, and they said, we don't believe this at all. But the other serious warning came in August 1941 when a character named Dusan Popov showed up at the offices of the FBI. Now, Popov was this fantastic character. He was a triple agent. He worked simultaneously for the Yugoslav intelligence community. He worked for the British, and he worked for the Nazis. And the Nazis had sent him to America with a 3-page questionnaire to fill out, and a whole third of that questionnaire was about Pearl Harbor. And he took this to the FBI, and he explained why it was suspicious. But because he was working for all these different sides, and because he was having an illicit affair with Simone, the star of Cat People, J. Edgar Hoover didn't take him seriously and refused to pass on the information.
He had three different code names for each different agency he was working for. You point out he was Disco to Yugoslavia, he was Tricycle to Britain, and the Germans knew him as Ivan.
Yes, exactly.
Very, very interesting character. So another thing that you talk a lot in the book about, which is something that other books have not focused on, is what was happening in Japan leading up to the attack. And while in the United States they saw Japan as this highly efficient, very organized, united nation, you present a very different picture in your book. What did you discover about the state of Japan and the state of war movements there?
Well, we have always been taught that the government in Japan was just like the Nazis. They were this unified fascist force constantly looking for world domination. And when we actually looked in the recent material on that history coming out of Japan, what we found was a nation that was really in total chaos. The army was fighting with the Navy. The army was fighting with the civilian government. The army had dragged the country into this sort of crazy war in China that was sort of like Japan's Vietnam. It was this morass and quagmire that they didn't really want to be there anymore, but they couldn't really bring themselves to get out of. And there was this constant struggle. And, of course, the country was poor in natural resources, and America did supply 80% of her petroleum. And she was looking for a way out of that. But even in all this territory they kept conquering across the 1930s, they could never find a solution for that. And you had this core nationalist fascist group who basically took over the government by assassinating civilian leaders. And after the war, when Hirohito was asked why he didn't do more to stop things, he said, well, if I had done more, I would have been assassinated or thrown into an asylum.
So, I mean, it must have been very difficult to find, track down some of the people that you found since it's been 75 years, but you were able to interview a number of survivors. And since we're talking about the Japanese effort, I wonder if you'd tell the story of, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Zenji Abe, who was an enemy dive bomber pilot.
Well, this is one of my favorite stories in the book. Zenji Abe was one of the lead pilots in the dive bomber group, and he felt like he had done a very good job during World War II. He went on to have a big military career, and after the war, he became a policeman. But then he discovered that Japan had not announced war before attacking Pearl Harbor, and he thought this was shameful. And he went on a campaign across the country to get his fellow airmen in the attack on Oahu to sign a letter of apology. And he took that letter and he flew to the United States and he tracked down one of the heads of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association who happened to live in Atlanta. And he showed up in Atlanta and knocked on the door and explained in his poor English what he was doing. And the guy said, the American said, well, you can take that letter and shove it where the sun don't shine, and slam the door in his face. And Abe was, of course, really upset, but he didn't give up. He got a group of Japanese aviators to start regularly attending Pearl Harbor Survivor Association reunions on December 7th in Hawaii. And at one of them, they met a Marine bugler who had been aboard the West Virginia named Richard Fisk. And Richard Fisk had had the horrible luck of surviving not only Pearl Harbor, but also Iwo Jima, which Fisk said was 32 days straight of Pearl Harbor. And during this, from this trauma that he'd gone through, Fisk had developed a visceral hatred of Japanese people. He just couldn't stand them. But when he saw these three old men like himself, old soldiers, decades later, he just reached out and started hugging them. And Abe and Fisk developed a friendship where Abe financed Fisk to go to the memorial every month and lay a white and a red rose and play taps in Japanese and in English. And eventually Fisk was given an Order of the Rising Sun by Emperor Akihito for promoting friendship between Japan and America. And when a Japanese man came and saw him at his very last reunion and touched his arm and burst into tears, Fisk said, "Don't cry. After all, my daughter married a Japanese boy, so what can you do?"
We're speaking with Craig Nelson. His new book is called Pearl Harbor, From Greatness to Infamy. I want to return to what's basically your argument in this book, and that you spent all these years researching in order to prove, I guess, which is that Pearl Harbor changed our entire country possibly forever. Why do you think Pearl Harbor has played such a huge role in the fact that there has been no World War III?
I think that Pearl Harbor and World War II were so devastating and so shocking and so traumatic that they turned American leaders into winners 1945 like no one else has ever won a world war. And one of the most amazing transformations is in Douglas MacArthur, who starts out in this book as kind of a stinker. And then when he shows up at the surrender, he says the most incredibly magnanimous, generous things about how it's time to stop the thinking of who's the enemy, who's the foe, and go on together in a world of peace. And after, in 1945, America did essentially reverse reparations. You know, when you win a big world war, you're supposed to get money and territory. You're not supposed to use your money to rebuild your enemies, but that's what we did. We used our money to rebuild Japan and Germany and a lot of Europe and a lot of Asia. And because of that program, George Marshall, the head of the army, who was then Secretary of State and started the Marshall Plan to rebuild, was the first professional soldier to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Mm. And in the same story, Cordell Hull, who was sort of a bumbling Secretary of State, in the end of it, he wins the Nobel Peace Prize for beginning the United Nations. Yeah. So it's an incredible ending to this story.
Craig Nelson is author of Pearl Harbor, From Great to Infamy. He'll tell other incredible stories at the Atlanta History Center on Monday, October 10th. Craig, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Here's a headline you may have missed. The story of a vanished frog species. You know, there have been some really big success stories when it comes to animal conservation. There were very few grizzly bears left in 1975, for example. Now there are hundreds. The bald eagle was brought back from the brink of extinction, and the green sea turtle has seen a huge increase in population in recent years. But there's no such happy ending for Tuffy, the last known member of his species. Tuffy was a Rab's fringe-limbed tree frog, and he lived at the Atlanta Botanical Garden in what's called a frog pod. These frogs have huge webbed hands and feet, and if they spread out their toes, they can glide from branch to branch. They've got great big eyes and flat heads, and they're pretty large for a frog. They can grow to almost 4 inches long, or at least they could. Tuffy was the only Rab's fringe-limbed tree frog in captivity, and scientists think he may have been the last of his kind anywhere. He earned his name because he didn't like to be touched. If one of the employees picked him up, he would pinch them. The frog was found in Panama in 2005 and had lived at the botanical garden ever since. Last week, Tuffy was found dead in his enclosure, and his species may have died with him.
It's not easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves.
Lots of people say they can't draw. Probably most people say they can't draw. And if they do doodle, like during a business meeting, they probably draw a box, maybe a three-dimensional box, something simple. But Atlanta-based illustrator Mike Lowry wants to start young when it comes to creating artists. He's the author of The Pursuit of the Pesky Pizza Pirate. It's part of a series of books that encourages kids to doodle in the book. Mike, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be here.
So, okay, here's my first question.
Okay, I'm
ready.
Being
a parent myself, I know how often when kids really like a book, they want to read that book over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So if they've doodled in this book, can't they only have the experience once?
Oh, no way. So that's the whole idea, right? So my daughter is 9, mm-hmm. and we buy a lot of the doodle books that are just kind of cheap paper that are meant to be that, you know, they say something really specific. I want you to draw an octopus. I want you to draw a polar bear or something like that. And what I found is that she wouldn't revisit these books when she was done with it. So this was the whole idea that that I had with my publisher, is that we would create something that's in between a comic book and a doodle book, and that it would be something that they would want to, because it actually tells a story.
Right.
Rather than just being these floating images. And you're exactly right. With these doodle books, it's typically something.
Well, the paper is like a coloring book.
Paper is thin,
really thin.
And it's something that the only person that would want to look at it later would be the kid's parents. Whereas with these books, hopefully, right, is that the kid is not just drawing in the book. They're helping to tell the story. And so then parents want to end up reading the story later and that sort of thing. Also, the thing that we noticed is that librarians now, which normally wouldn't keep a doodle book in the library, obviously.
Because they don't want kids scribbling in their books.
Right, yeah. But I'm encouraging that they scribble in all books. No, just these books,
I was obviously. Just about to say, kind of like...
Kids out there, go to the libraries, draw in the books. No, but the idea would be that, so now librarians are getting these books, and they're picking certain students to fill out pages. And then when they put it in the catalog in the library, they're listing both me and those kids as the author.
Oh, how funny.
So now other kids are going and checking out books from, you know, their classmates and things like that.
So since you mentioned your daughter, let's hear from her. We spoke with your 9-year-old daughter, Alistair, and it sounds like you're training her early.
When I grow up, I would like to be an author and illustrator for children's books, like my dad. I like to draw cats because I think they're hilarious, and I love to draw unicorns because I think they're really funny. I really love to draw, and I think it's a fun activity because my dad does it, and I really think I'm good at it.
So is she good at it? You can tell me. We won't. I'll never tell her.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. She might listen to this. She is good at it. She's always been really creative about stuff. I mean, I guess everybody sees certain things about their kids, right, mm-hmm. that they're really excited about, and they really push in those things. And so luckily, one of the things that I really like just happens to be something she's really good at. And she's really good at drawing, but she's also, she keeps journals on her own. I mean, without me pushing her to do it, of these little stories and things like that, or stories about trips that we'll take or something like that. This is something that I do a lot, is every day I keep a sketchbook, which is also kind of a journal diary type thing. And I do think that that's one area that she saw and she's picked up on that. So if we travel together, I like to draw little things about our day, and she does the same sort of thing.
You both seem to think it's hilarious to draw cats.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, why not? Everybody likes
drawing cats. That's a passion that you enjoy. And that's actually, oddly enough, we spoke with our producer, Sean Powers, spoke with another kid, 11-year-old Lucia Rodriguez of Atlanta. And she says that for your book, she drew both herself and an animal that would help. The main character in this is Carl the duck.
Yep.
And she drew an animal to help Carl.
Okay.
I draw a cat. His name is Chuck. He stands up and he wears dark glasses. There was this one that said, put one that crosses so you can cross the bridge. And I put the cat that he was stretching over and so they could walk over him.
So, okay. The idea behind getting kids to doodle. What's your darker secret mission here, Mike? What are you really trying to make kids do?
So, you know, I think that it started with more of it being a personal. So I keep lists of all of the things that I really want to accomplish. And some of it, you know, sounds
like life plans.
Some of it is. And some of it's just personal goals or professional goals. In a personal way, years ago, I made a list of, you know, how do I want to spend my time? You know, how do I want to make money in terms of how it relates back to, number one being family, second being that I like to travel also with my family, and then the third being how I spend my time making art and turning that in. So anyway, so some of them are really big like that, and then some of them are, I want to do a project that has a duck as a narrator who's really grumpy, right? So those are pretty...
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished with one of those. Yeah, so then the idea for this one was that I just kind of combined together some of the things that I wanted to do in a project. I wanted to make a book that 9 to 14-year-old me would have just loved, and it's all pizza jokes and pirate jokes, and then the other one is about, there's a new one coming out that's about a robotic cat that's made out of old tuna cans, so his robot smells terrible. And then there's one about space slugs and stuff like that. So that's all kind of
space
part of that.
Space slugs.
Space slugs.
You kind of slid that in there.
Yeah. You know,
pardon the pun.
We can focus on it for a minute if you want. Space slugs to me. So that was all the initial idea, right? There wasn't a bigger picture idea. And then the more that I started working on it, I really wanted it, like I mentioned before, I wanted it to be like a comic graphic novel type thing mixed with drawing, which is the thing that I do all the time. And what it turned into, I realized as I was writing the story and I was writing jokes that I'd liked, that I thought my kid Alistair might like, I started realizing that something bigger came out of it, which was this idea that reluctant readers is a big topic right now in this age range. There's a lot of books that are really targeting kids that are reluctant to read. And what we learned with this one is this targeted those kids, but it also targeted kids that are reluctant artists.
So I want to play, Sean spoke with a number of kids. So here's 9-year-old Mackenzie Burns of Atlanta. And she also says she doodles in your book. And that she says that because of you, she's created some really interesting characters that she really likes. So here she is. Here's Mackenzie.
Well, there's one that I drew a while back, and it's called Flying Turtle. And it's this turtle. that has an umbrella on a shell. Bunnies, they can hop, and birds, they can fly, but turtles just kind of sit on the ground and do nothing. So why can't turtles fly too? He has a sidekick, and the sidekick is a porcupine who likes to jump over things. They're just kind of a team.
Okay, so in addition to her flying turtle and her amazing jumping porcupine, Mackenzie, I guess she kind of sees it sort of as a journal the way you do. So here's what she says about all of her drawings.
I'd forgotten what was going on in my mind at that point. And I'm sure if I could go back in time, I would have written it down somewhere, although my spelling would have been kind of bad. The drawings, it helped me further extend my imagination in my writing and spelling work. And it's definitely helped me get better grades.
So you're catching kids kind of on both ends of their educational careers, right?
Yeah, right.
What does the drawing accomplish?
Well, it's all part of this bigger picture thing, which is when I go to schools and talk at elementary schools, or even if I talk at AIGA or these Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrator events and things like that, it's always the same. It always has, at least has this one similar theme, which is to keep a sketchbook. And the idea is that I don't think of a sketchbook in the way that I think some artists have been taught to think of a sketchbook, or the way that people who are not artists think of a sketchbook, in terms of you go to a coffee shop, you set up this easel, you know, or you're on this French river.
Right. Right. Or overlooking a cliff side.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. And I'll keep describing more scenes and you'll just make sort of sound effects.
Right.
For,
okay.
With those. You know, I don't think of a sketchbook as being like that, as this really sacred space that you can't make any wrong marks. I really do think of it as this constant thing that becomes this exercise space where you can kind of keep practicing and it gives you a chance to play around. And I think that for some people it might be drawing, and for some people it might be making notes or lists and things like that. And then they can kind of play off of the way that they're using that sketchbook. And I think that these books are kind of meant to do that, where I think that if people look at the kind of illustration that I've put in the books, they don't feel intimidated to do their own version of something to go along with the story.
So you mentioned the AIGA, which is the American Institute of Graphic Arts, I believe. I'm speaking with Atlanta illustrator Mike Lowry. He's the author of the new children's book, The Pursuit of the Pesky Pizza Pirate, and it encourages kids to doodle. Let's hear, here's another interesting point made by 11-year-old, clearly genius, Lucia Rodriguez of Atlanta. But she believes that drawing helps her in all of the subjects in her classrooms. Here she is.
Sometimes I just doodle random stuff. Sometimes I doodle flowers. Sometimes I doodle, I try to doodle a dog, which I'm not really good at. But I think, drawing makes me, because in math you need to do equations, and sometimes my drawing helps me think better and focus more on the drawings.
I realize you're biased toward doodling, but do you buy that argument that doodling actually helps a math student?
I think that I think that it all kind of spills over into this, I don't know, maybe just this idea that staying active and letting your brain play a lot would allow you then to think that there might be alternative ways of looking at an answer, or looking other ways of thinking of an answer, meaning maybe doodling allows you to find new ways of accessing bits of your memory that you wouldn't have thought of before, in terms of how certain people might find alternative ways of studying that it points.
Right.
I think somebody else would have found to be absurd. I can't think of an example.
Like a duck that's so hungry for pizza that he becomes cranky.
Do you think that that's absurd? I think
it's objectively absurd.
Artistic genius, which is... Yeah.
Okay, so I have to ask you before we go one last controversial question, and I'm going to have to insist that you weigh in.
Okay, here
okay.
we go.
Do you tell the truth about your kids' drawings, whether they're good or not?
To the kid or?
To the kid.
Yeah.
There is a big controversy about this, because there are those who say you don't tell your kid their drawing's beautiful if it's awful, and they just scribbled it in 4 seconds.
Right.
And those who say, look, you need to encourage your kid in all things. So where are you on this? Do you tell them the truth or not?
Okay, it's a little bit of a longer answer, but I'm going to cut it down.
Okay.
I'm going to shave off some stuff. So it kind of goes back to this idea when I was teaching. So I taught college age students for about 15 years, and I had this question come up a lot where they would, where not necessarily one of the students, but maybe a parent, maybe someone outside of the school would say, what do you do when you have a student that just doesn't have it? You know, it being bold or italicized or whatever.
Talent, I think they're talking about.
Yeah, and I think that this idea of what is good is so arbitrary and subjective that a kid's drawing, if a kid is drawing, you can't say something is bad because they're actually sitting down and they're trying to be creative on something. So maybe the good of them working on this in general would be the fact that they're entertaining themselves for 20 minutes or something like that. So what I'm trying to say is, I'm not trying to skirt around and not answer the question, but meaning, how could I as a professor tell a student that they don't have what it takes or whatever to become an illustrator? Because I don't think that the work that I'm doing when I was in grad school, there's no way that a professor would look at this and think like, oh, well, this is good.
Okay, you sound like an art teacher. Let me play you this comment from Marco. He also is an adult doodler.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds bad. He doodles as an adult.
It's not bad. It's what I make a living
and
doing. So
he says he tries not to criticize his daughters all that much.
I love to draw, and I still draw a lot. Every time that I have a napkin and a pen, I will be drawing something. So they do the same, and it's not that I want it in a specific way, but I will always try to, okay, I think that this could look better. I always say, okay, if you're copying something from the real life, look at the shadow, look at the reflection, look at how, but they can draw whatever they want.
Okay. So if you're going to critique your kids' drawings,
mm-hmm.
if you just saw them, took a, you know, puce-colored crayon and scribble something in 4 seconds, and they say, hey, Dad, isn't this beautiful? How do you do that without squelching their imagination?
So I think the idea is that you just, as long as you're not dismissive, that's the only problem, is that then you have to look at whatever you want for the kid to focus on more meaning. And maybe, I mean, maybe you're not an art professor, and maybe you don't have the training to say whether something is working or not versus good.
Your perspective is off there.
Yeah, right. So I give Alistair a bunch of art history volumes that she has to pore over every night before bed. And, you know, there's a lot of crying at the house, and she keeps writing art with a circle and a line through it all over her walls. But
no,
I think that the idea is that you just encourage them to push forward. And, I mean, but this is in everything that they do, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they can't just stay in their comfort zone and just, they do a couple of quick squiggle marks. You're not going to constantly say, oh, you know, we're going to like lift her up and raise her through the house.
Right. Let's take down the Van Gogh and put
right, up. Exactly. And so then I don't keep necessarily all the quick sketch stuff. I mean, her house is only so big, you know, and then I push her to say, okay, now let's try this. And so in that way, then it's not dismissive and it's interactive, where I'm interacting with her and engaging her and trying to push her forward and whatever she's doing.
Okay, wise words from Atlanta illustrator Mike Lowry. He is author of the new children's book, The Pursuit of the Pesky Pizza Pirate. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Does the American dream still exist? And if it does, has it changed? Tomorrow, comedian John Fugelsang joins us to talk about his latest project. It's an examination of how we define life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Your voice is pretty important in this conversation, so tell us if you think the American dream is still relevant, or maybe it's an old-fashioned notion. You can call us at 404-500-9457 and leave us a message, and then be sure to join us Friday at 9 a.m. for more. Millions of Jews were displaced by the Holocaust in the 1940s. Many survivors were forced to find new homes and rebuild their lives on foreign shores. Author Jonathan Rabb explores this very difficult transition in his new novel, Among the Living. The book is set in 1947, when concentration camp survivor Itzhak Golden travels to Savannah, and his new life demands that he face some complex divisions within Savannah's Jewish community. Author Jonathan Rabb joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have to be honest with you that when they handed me this book to read for this interview, the first thing I thought was, oh God, another novel about Holocaust survivors. But I was surprised because what you have found landed on is a subject that I just don't think I've ever read about before, which is the difficulty that survivors had even relating with their own Jewish community, that even among the Jews, they didn't know what to say to survivors. How did you come to this particular subject matter?
Well, it's funny. I mean, so many people have said it's a Holocaust novel. I don't look at it that way. I moved down to Savannah, and just I'd like to say I hope everybody in Savannah and the path of Matthew today is safe. But we moved down to Savannah, and you know, I didn't know anything about Southern Jewry at the time. I'd grown up in the Northeast. And so I felt like an outsider. So I needed to bring a character there who also didn't know anything about Southern Jewry. And it just made sense to me to bring someone at that time, I've always done historical fiction, to a place where there was a fractured Jewish community. And yes, his experience is the Holocaust in the past, but it's someone who is trying to find his way through that. And when he gets to Savannah, this division in the Jewish community between the Reform and Conservative is sort of absurd to him because these sorts of things don't make sense. And even a character in the book at one point says, we know this must be absurd to you, but it's who we are. And finding the difficulty in explaining an experience that no one who didn't go through that experience could have, whether they were Jew or non-Jew, is going to make it very, very difficult for him. And that's why later in the book, I bring in another character who has survived a concentration camp as well. And she is a very, very different voice. He is able to find his way through. I mean, he does come back to the living. She, I'm not so sure. And she has a very powerful line at one point where she says to him, in the book, these people will never understand you, and you will never understand them. And she doesn't say it to demean, to in any kind of judgmental
way. No, she's
way.
Just...
It's the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the choice
And
for
he doesn't
him,
argue with her either.
No, of course not. Of course not. But he's been there longer than she has. And, of course, he has found someone in the Jewish community, although he's in the conservative community, the woman he falls
yeah,
in love
like
with
Romeo
is reformed.
And Juliet.
Sure, sure,
yeah.
sure. My wife was very happy that I... finally, in one of my books, have a love story, although I made it tough on him, so that's just me. But, you know, he has a very different experience. But, you know, I had a cousin who, in fact, I dedicate the book to my great uncle and aunt and cousin who all miraculously survived the war. And my cousin was only 9 years old when he was in a camp. And I would see him from moved to New York. He was there. And we would have breakfast many, many mornings. And he was an accountant. He was living a normal life. But you could see that there was something, obviously, that was still shattered inside. And
this part was very interesting to me because nobody knows what to say to him, Itzhak. It's almost as though he himself doesn't know what they should be saying. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the Holocaust. It just reminded me of pretty much anyone who's lived through a horrific tragedy of some kind.
Any kind of trauma. What are you supposed to, and you have your sort of list of things. There's a scene in the book where people start asking him, what was it like? And internally, he's thinking to himself, you know, all right, here are the questions. I'll answer them the way I usually do. And at a certain point, they get to the question. And inside, he said, in his head, he says, here it comes. I know it's going to come. And the question always is, how could you have not known? How could you have not gotten out? And, you know, that I think is one of the questions that people always ask of people going through traumas. And I always bring up the example of, I was living in New York with my wife in 2001, and walking down the streets in August, none of us were thinking to ourselves, gosh, you know, in about a month, the whole world is going to change. You're not aware of these epic things that are going on, and history just sort of moves you along. How could you not know? How could you not get out? It's almost a nonsensical question at a certain point, and yet you have to answer it. And you know, he's still just trying to find his way. And I think you sort of turn on an automatic pilot at a certain point to confront those kinds of questions. I think. At least he did. That was the character I created.
How did you go about figuring that out, though? I mean, what kind of research do you do to get inside the mind of a trauma victim? Because I've never been through that kind of trauma.
Sure.
But so I would have no idea what that experience would be like.
Well, I mean, obviously, I projected a lot onto my cousin, who was my father's generation. And, you know, but this was years ago. I had the idea to write a book with him as, not him, but a character like that. But I was living in New York at the time, and it just seemed too obvious to set this kind of story in New York. When we moved down to Savannah about 8 years ago, and as I said, I needed an outsider, suddenly there was this confluence of ideas that I'd had for a long time, and they came together. Projecting onto someone I knew, but also there are many, many beautiful books out there. I'm a huge fan of, if one can be, but I think he's a beautiful writer, is Primo Levi. And his, you know, Survival in Auschwitz and any number of the books, both fiction and nonfiction, are extraordinary because you read these books, especially Survival in Auschwitz, and there isn't an element of judgment going on. And that to me is fascinating. He simply depicts what it was like to be in that concentration camp very, very vividly. But he never takes out, you know, his knife to take back against the Nazis. It's extraordinary what he could do. And it's this wonderful stillness within him. And I wanted to give that to my character, which means he's a very quiet character. And that was the bigger challenge because in fiction, people want big, you know, characters that dominate a scene. And he's not that. And
we never get the full story of what happened to him either.
No, and I don't think anybody ever will. Even the woman but I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, the woman he falls in love with, she never fully finds out. And I think it's a sweet moment between them where she says to him at one point, she said, I always thought that you didn't speak that much because of the language. But no, you're wonderful at English. It's something else. And that's true. And yet he is able to open up to her in some ways. But I think opening up about those things fully means you have to relive them fully. And I don't think anybody wants to do that, especially him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is author Jonathan Rabb. His new novel is called Among the Living. It's set in Savannah after World War II. There's a lot of resonances to this story. First of all, we get in a racism with the African-American characters that are in there. What kind of research did you have to do to recreate Savannah of 1947?
Well, it's one of the most fun I've ever had because in my books, the previous books that I'd done, it take place in Berlin in 1919, 27, Spain in 36. You know, there were people I could have interviewed, but no one, you know, very, very few. This book, became very, very friendly with a man who unfortunately passed away a few years ago at the age of 97. And he and I became very friendly. He said, I'm going to set up a lunch for you. And I went to the lunch at his house, and there were six people there. I think I probably brought the average age down to about 89. And, you know, I came with a legal pad filled with questions, ready to go. We sat down, I asked the first question, and I didn't speak for the next 3 hours. It was incredible. These members of the Jewish community, both the Reform and the Conservative, and they just started talking to each other about that time. And it was as if they were transported back there, and I was there with them. And in fact, I stole one of the names. One of the crucial character in the book is the housekeeper for the Jesslers, the people he comes to live with. Her name is Mary Royal. Well, that was one of the names of one of these women's housekeepers. And I loved that touch of Royal. It was just wonderful because on some level, you mentioned that, you know, issues of racism come up. The African-American community on some level is the moral compass. in this book for the simple reason that, you know, Yitzhak can't possibly understand what it is to be an African-American man, a black man living in the Jim Crow South. But he can certainly hear echoes of his own recent past and the way they're continuing to be treated, so much so that he begins to feel a greater affinity for the black community than even for his own family.
And more comfortable.
Well, I mean, in some ways. There's a moment where he's sort of driving down the street with this lovely young man named Raymond. And, you know, things happen to Raymond in the book. They're talking, and it just is very clear that Raymond is telling him, you know, next time, don't extend your hand to shake my hand. You know, just don't do that. And Yitzhak sort of sits back and thinks to himself, how easy is it to now be on the other side of this? I mean, it's just extraordinary. So he has to be able to see that experience, even though he obviously can't have known what it is to be living in the South as a black man at the time.
And to some extent, the book is about the fact that we can't really know what it's like to be anybody else.
No.
That everybody's experiences mean that we can't truly understand them.
Right. But even, yes, the Jews in Savannah can't possibly know what it is to, you know, to be. It's, we are alone on some level with those big ideas, and we have to process them ourselves, even though there are people around who you think, obviously those people will understand, but they can't. All they can do is open their arms and say, we're here. What else can we do? And on some level, Yitzhak begins to do that, as do the Jesslers, for the black community in Savannah, as best as they can, given the time. It's not perfect. This book doesn't end on a
little
bow. I mean, it's 1947 Savannah. I mean, one of the other things as I wrote the book, and I discovered this as I wrote the book, you know, growing up, I always knew about the relationship between the African-American community and the Jewish community during civil rights. It's both a positive and a troubling relationship and so forth, but it didn't just spring up. It had to have come from somewhere. So having a story that takes place in 1947, I needed to see if there were kernels of that beginning to bubble just beneath the surface, as I said, in Savannah. And I think there were between those two communities. But again, there were the limitations of the time.
So there's other resonances, certainly, to modern times. I mean, if you think about the state of not just racism, but look at the refugee crisis at this point. In what ways did you feel as though you were writing? I mean, you specialize in historical novels, and yet in a way, a successful historical novel needs to be timeless, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
How much is that in your head while you're writing?
It's a great question. I don't think those questions can be in your head. You have to, as a novelist, this is the difference between being a historian and being a novelist.
Yeah.
You know, as a novelist, I have to live in the moment with my characters. They have to make their choices. This, you know, I tell my students, if you try and write about the big ideas, you know, this book is about identity and alienation, and so you'll bore the reader beyond measure, and you'll never get to what really makes characters human, what really makes the story, as you say, universal. You've got to deal with the moment to moment and the things that matter to them. I mean, history is the backdrop, but you're dealing with intimate lives, small lives, and those have to, you know, pulse with their own, you know, what motivates them as individuals. Small choices. Do we go to this dinner? Do we not? At the same time, as you step back from the actual writing of the book and get more into, you know, the moments that you're away, you know, you do see these bigger ideas. But if you heavy pedal them too much, you become a pedant. You just are sort of up on your soapbox trying to teach people something, and they won't connect to it. They've got to connect to the individual characters. And then, hopefully, you know, the reader will put two and two together, and then you'll get that kind of resonance at the end of the book. I started writing this book, you know, 2-3 years ago. And even though this is still, you know, these issues still challenge us, it's really been in the last year and a half that things have exploded so much, especially in the news.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't anticipate that. But these are issues that aren't going away. And I'm not going to say that I sat down and said, I'm going to write about this. But I don't think you can live in this country and not recognize that those are the issues that are there. And I don't, as I said, I didn't write a Holocaust book. I don't think I'm writing historical fiction. I know that sounds weird. But I think I'm just, I found characters, I found a moment that makes sense to me. And it must make sense to me because of the moment that I'm living in. I mean, I'm not just going back to paint you a picture of something pretty in the past. I'm drawn to it because obviously I have concerns, my own anxieties about those issues. I just happen to find my characters in the moment in the past.
That is author Jonathan Rabb. He's a professor of writing at SCAD and author of the new book, Among the Living. He'll speak at the Atlanta History Center tonight at 7 o'clock. You can get more information at gppnews.org. Jonathan, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you.